Welcome to City Professional English Podcasts, podcast number 23, Agreeing and Disagreeing in Meetings. Have you ever found yourself in the position where, after disagreeing with someone in a meeting, they have become rather hostile to you in the subsequent weeks? Did you wonder whether it may have been your linguistic skills that had caused a negative reaction of your colleague? Or did you simply want to make your view public, with little concern to anything else? This podcast takes these two language functions of agreeing and disagreeing and changes them into two powerful techniques that will both increase your effectiveness and dramatically improve your relationships with your colleagues. I hope you enjoy this podcast and find it useful. Let me please begin this podcast by apologizing. I haven't done a podcast for 2 weeks. This is the first one in 2 weeks, and that's not the usual type of time frame that I stick to. No excuses. Do apologize. I will really try in future for that not to happen. My idea is to release a podcast every week, and I failed to do that, so apologies. Agreeing and disagreeing in meetings. As many of you know, I think that meetings are a fantastic opportunity. I hope you're not laughing. The people who are listening to this podcast who have been at work for quite some time will probably be thinking, yeah, I know that, Mark, but I don't really agree. The meetings I go to are a waste of time. And in fact, that's what the research says. It's common knowledge that people say 70% of the meetings they go to are a waste of time. And that's really unfortunate. The crucial reason as to why they're a waste of time is because the people who are running the meetings do not know how to run effective meetings. And it's not that difficult. It's just a few techniques they need to learn. Today, however, I'm not going to concentrate on how to run an effective meeting. I will do a podcast on that. But today I want to look at a couple of language functions of agreeing and disagreeing in meetings, language functions which are used an awful lot, or at least should be used an awful lot in a meeting. That's if you want to have debate and discussion, of course. And really showed that these two language functions, combined with a couple of behavioral techniques, can become very, very powerful and very crucial for your career development. So as I said, I believe meetings are a fantastic opportunity to practice all of the business skills, the professional skills you will need as you develop in your career. Whether you be someone who is not at managerial level yet and has been given the opportunity to run a meeting, or you're already at executive level and you want to practice some leadership skills, meetings are a fantastic and very low-risk way to practice these types of skills. And it's fortunate that I believe they're fantastic opportunities because we spend so much time in them. Today, what are the 3 points we're going to look at? I have 3 points. What are meetings best suited for? 2, the linguistic issues, what phrases are best to use with these two language functions. And 3, what I call the path to high-performance meetings, the combination of effective behavior and solid relationship building. These are 3 points I'd like to look at today. So what are meetings best suited for? Well, as you all know very well, there are many types of meetings used under very different types of names. You have the staff meeting, the weekly staff meeting, you have project meetings, you have brainstorming meetings, you have one-to-ones, you have the number ones, you have commercial types of meetings, you have presentational types of meetings. They're an awful lot. And each one of these meetings is going to have a slightly different structure. However, it is my belief that every single type of meeting requires certain effective behaviors and certain techniques to build relationships. And I'll explain both of those later on in this podcast. But my focus today will be on, or mainly on, the regular type of meetings you have with colleagues, rather than the one-off type of meeting that you may have with a prospective client or current clients. I'm talking about the regular meetings you have, particularly with your colleagues. And the reason I'm going to focus on these types of meetings is because those are the majority of meetings that we have. And meetings are important. And they're important because you are putting together a group of people into one room, and you need to justify why you're doing this. There's a company in America I heard of that they have a clock in their meeting room, and by the way, any company that does not have a huge clock on the wall in their meeting room speaks volumes about what that company feels about the most precious resource that we have in our lives, time. It is absolutely incredible to me that meeting rooms do not have enormous big clocks in them. Just incredible. Anyway, there's one company that I heard of in America, and instead of, well, they actually have a normal clock, but they have another clock. And what they do is, before the meeting, someone punches into a computer the salaries of each of the people who are going to participate in the meeting. And while the meeting is going on, rather than a normal clock, which moves by time, every minute that goes past, this clock changes to record or to demonstrate how many dollars have been spent by those group of people, by this group of people being in that room for that time. You know, each minute $1,000, or each minute $500, or so and so forth. And that's, when I heard of that, I thought that was brilliant, because it does show very vividly that meetings are an extremely big cost for companies. Putting a group of people into one room to do one thing is costly, and therefore it needs to be effective. A company simply can't allow meetings to not be very productive and not be very effective. It's just, you're trying to save costs, you're trying to save more money in other places, that's a good place to start. So the next question is, what are meetings best suited for? If they're going to cost so much money, if they are so expensive, what are they best suited for? Now, many people have different opinions on this. Some people believe that they're a fantastic opportunity to share information. And indeed, when we're talking about a staff meeting, like a weekly staff meeting, that is quite true. It's a great opportunity to get your team, your group, together, where you can all share what you've accomplished, what you need help on, what you have heard or seen that can help other people, and to improve the sort of communication within your team. That I can understand. But even with that situation, I still personally believe that information sharing, simply information sharing, is not a very effective use of the time in a meeting. I mean, you could say, if you were just going to share information, so you were just going to give a presentation to the rest of your colleagues, maybe you could do that, write it, and it be a PDF, which you send to them, and they can read at their leisure. I know that's going to seem a little bit cold, particularly with a staff meeting, when particularly when people are trying to build up teams, but personally, I still feel that it's not very effective to have a group of people in a room where one or two of them are going to share information with the other. In my view, meetings should be about the three D's. The three D's are debate, discussion, and decision. When you have your team in a room, your whole team in a room, or any group of people in a room, you want to use all of the resources there. You want to use their experience, their knowledge, their skills, their the way in which they do business to improve what you're doing or to seek out new solutions to something. You want to be told if you're doing something wrong. I remember when I was running my company in London, there were quite a few occasions when some of the people who were working for me, you know, pointed out to me, "Mark, that's, I don't think that's going to work. Are you sure about that?" And that's fantastic. If you're the boss of a company, if you're the leader of the company, and particularly if your company is of a particularly big dimension, you simply cannot have people on your board or in your meeting rooms who do not put the hand up and say, "I don't think that's right." You can't have it. You know, sooner or later, if you run your company like that, you're going to make a wrong decision, and it's going to be fatal for the company, or near fatal for the company. No one person can run big multinational companies. They cannot do it. They need people behind them. And they only can have those people behind them if they develop the situation where these people feel secure about taking risks, secure about saying, "I'm not sure you're right," secure about saying, "I think we should do something else." Developing this atmosphere where people feel secure that they're not going to be prejudged by what they say is a particular skill for any manager, any executive, any leader that you must learn. And if you learn it and you can develop it, this is where it comes to its fore in meetings, where you have people who are together, who debate and discuss and then form decisions. And to have that situation, not only do you have to develop this this feeling within the company of security, and I don't mean by way security of job, although some in some circumstances I do, I mean more security of what people judge of them. You mean if you put your hand up and say, "I don't understand why we're doing this," you want, as a leader, you want people to do that, to feel happy enough to do that, that they are not going to be considered unprofessional or stupid, that they do not understand something. I hope I've been able to, in a very short time, explain that, what I mean by the feeling of security. But you don't just need that. You also need to be able to run effective meetings. Because if you cannot run an effective meeting, it's going to be very difficult to make, at the end of it, effective decisions. If you do not have an agenda, if you run over time, always, if you don't provide effective decisions, these meetings are not going to be very worthwhile of the time which is spent in them. So the three D's is the debate, the discussion, and the decisions are really what I think every single meeting should be about. The difficulty is, it's easy to say that, but it's very difficult. Actually, no, it's not very difficult. That's wrong. It's actually very easy to develop it. It just requires a little bit of patience, a little bit of time, and a lot of consistency. There's a management consultant in America. I've mentioned them before, Manager Tools. And they say this wonderful thing that there's never been a film in Hollywood about a manager, because being a manager is a boring role. You have to do the same things consistently over time so that people know how you're going to react to any one particular situation. And that's why it's a difficult job, because you have to do the same things. You have to create this idea of security with people, that they know what you're going to be about. And it is easy. It just requires certain techniques. So let's talk about some of these techniques now. The first one, we're going to look at the linguistic issues. Because many people these days take part in international meetings where English is being used as their second language. And the bad news with this is that for meetings in particular, you need many language functions. You need the language functions of how to clarify, how to persuade, how to ask questions, how to negotiate, how to give an opinion, how to ask for an opinion, how to present an argument. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And the thing is that in a meeting which is public, it's difficult. It's quite pressurized when you're using your second language to come up with all of these language functions in the right moment. In a subsequent podcast, I'm going to look at each of these language functions, and one of them which is going to be particularly interesting for people is interrupting. Because that's more, although it's a linguistic skill, it's also a social skill. And that'll be very interesting to both for me to do and hopefully for you to listen to. So that's the bad news. The good news, as I try to do with City Professional English, is I'm going to give you only one phrase per function, because I told you the bad news before, but I didn't tell you the terrible news. The terrible news is that for every language function, there are many, many options, many, many phrases that can be used for that function. So what I'm going to try to do is give you the language functions of agreeing and disagreeing, and just give you one phrase to use. The reason I'm doing that is hopefully that it'll be easier for you to remember in the heat of the moment of a meeting where you need to agree or disagree with someone. Because it's all very well studying a second language in the cold situation of a classroom or online or so on and so forth. But when you're in the heat of the moment, when you're sitting there in an international meeting, and it may even be an international video conference meeting, and there's people talking, and it's very important. There are some of your colleagues there, some of your peers, some of the people who are above you in the organization, where you need to make a good impression, or you don't need to make a good impression, but it would be good if you made a good impression. It's an opportunity, for you to make a good impression with your bosses. And you know, you have six options as to how to convey agreement. So I'm going to give you one. And let's look at the first one. The function is to agree with someone. And what do you say? You say, "I agree." I know that's going to sound I mean, it is simple, it is easy. A lot of people, particularly with backgrounds in Latin languages, there doesn't exist the verb to agree. The agreement is actually suggested via an adjective. So they would say, a mistake that I often hear is, I am agree, which is wrong. So, to repeat, the language function to agree with someone is, I agree. That's it. Very easy. Sometimes, however, you do want to agree, and you want to also give yourself some flexibility, some maneuver. This language function is, I agree up to a point, and I would like to add blah, 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 blah. So I agree up to a point, and da, da, da. Those are the only two language functions that you will need to use when you wish to agree with something or someone in a meeting. That's it. Be careful not to use the word but. Often, people will say, I agree up to a point, but could we look at this? Or, I agree, but could we look at this? The problem with but is that but is negative, and it has a function of negating everything which came before it. So if you say, I agree, but could we look at issue number two again? It actually means that you don't agree. So from a linguistic point of view, it's not the correct thing to use. You should use and. I agree and I'd like us to look over again point two. It also, from a communication point of view, from what the listener hears, if you say to someone, I agree with what you're saying, but can we look at blah blah, the listener will not hear the I agree with. They will hear the but. They will take away from that sentence the negative side. And as soon as they hear but, they're going to become a little bit more defensive. And unless you have a wonderful relationship with that person, not wonderful, sorry, that's the wrong adjective to use. Unless you have a very strong, solid, professional relationship with that person, they're going to close up a little bit, which is not what you want in a meeting. So be very careful of the use of the word but. Use and instead. So I agree up to a point and, I agree and, just get used to that. I've put a little quick point here that I wanted to mention about interrupting. Very quick, because as I said, I'm going to do a podcast on that. When you interrupt people, you should try to interrupt people when they pause. There really should only be one person speaking at a time in a meeting. Don't allow meetings to descend into some chaotic situation where you have many people talking at the same time. I know many of you are probably thinking that doesn't happen, but I promise you, I see it all of the time. Quite a few of the meetings that I go to observe, I see this happen. So try only to speak one at a time, so you can interrupt when the person pauses. You don't have to wait till they completely finish their point, but when they pause. Let's now look at the other side of the coin, the function of disagreeing. First of all, disagreeing, and particularly in English, I think, or at least that's my sensation, it's always a good idea for it to be softened. Strong phrases which demonstrate strong disagreement, I don't think, are a very effective phrase to be used in the professional world. So for the function to disagree, you begin by softening, by using the phrase, I'm afraid. not I'm sorry. Because I'm sorry really means something which you have done something wrong. And in this case, that isn't the case. The I'm afraid is just trying to soften your disagreement with the person. But then you have to express your disagreement. So the function is, I'm afraid I cannot agree with you on that. I'm afraid I cannot agree with you on that. Or, I think in this particular case, I might give you two options, which is very unusual for me, for the reasons which I stated earlier. The other version is, I cannot agree with you on that, which is basically the same, except I haven't put I'm afraid in. Now that leads us to a very interesting question. When do you use I'm afraid? When do you choose to soften it? And when do you not? And that all depends upon the quality of your relationship with the person. And I call this section of the podcast that we're going to talk about now, The Path to High Performance Meetings. And to describe what I'm trying to get at here, I'm going to use an analogy. And for some people, this is going to seem a very strange analogy, because I'm going to compare probably the most important relationship in your life with professional relationships. And the reason I'm going to use this as an analogy, first of all for effect, which is the reason why you choose the correct analogy to use, but secondly, to illustrate my firm belief that there is very little difference between building solid relationships in your private life and building solid relationships at work. I really don't think there's any difference whatsoever. So, to try to talk about with the function to disagree when you use I'm afraid, when you soften the blow, as we say in English, let me ask you this question. What is the best relationship in your life? The most solid? Most people will say their wife or their husband or their partner. The person, their companion in life, as it were, who they've been with for some years. And I know some people listening to this podcast for some decades. The second question I want you to think about is, why is it the best? Now, I don't want to delve into your personal life, and of course I can't via a podcast, but I can talk for myself. The reason why the relationship I have with my wife is the best relationship I have, well, there are many reasons, but I have to say that respect for each other is very high up on that list. It's the fact that Francesca, my wife, and I can say pretty much anything to each other, as long as it is said with some gentleness, of course, and neither of us will respect the other less. Because we've been together for, we've been together for 11 years, you get to know the person, you know, share passions, you share challenges, difficult periods, and you gain respect from that person by knowing them, by caring for them. And so the person can actually say almost anything, and you don't lose that respect. Now, of course, at the beginning of your relationship with your wife, your husband, your partner, it wasn't like that. That level of respect and caring wasn't there. What was the path that you took to arrive at the quality of relationship you have with your partner now? And if we go right back to the beginning, you did things like you took care about how you dressed. If you're a woman, you took care about, you know, your makeup and how your hair was done. You would arrive on time. If you said that you were going to pick her up at 10 o'clock. You'd arrive there just before 10 o'clock, probably in my place at 9, and walk around nervous beforehand. But you'd arrive on time. You'd buy tickets in advance. You wouldn't wait to get to the actual venue and find out there all the tickets are sold out. You'd be, from the logistical point of view, you'd be very effective. From a more emotional relationship point of view, you'd listen very attentively when the person spoke. You'd have an intensity of feeling, and you would choose to care. These things you did at the beginning of your relationship set you on the path, on the road, to the quality of relationship you have now. And all that is effective behavior plus solid relationship building. And there is no difference between this and what you do in your private and what you do in your professional life. Neither is force. Neither is trying to score points. Is, well, I listened to you attentively, now you must listen to me. You did it almost in a sense of the joy of giving. Now, of course, in the back of your mind, you had the idea that, you know, if you made the effort with this person, you would, you know, create a wonderful relationship. And that's in the back of your mind, of course. But is it force, then, to do the things that you did at the beginning? The care you took and how effective you were? I don't think it was. It was purposeful. You had a purpose to achieve. And I think that's very different between being force. My point in all of this is the quality of relationship that you have with your partner, because of the amount of respect that you have and because of the route that you took to arrive there, is the goal of the type of relationships you want to have in the professional world. Now, I know that's going to sound strange to people, but if you manage to get to the situation where the people you are working with, there is that amount of respect that you can practically say anything, obviously in a professional manner, and they will not judge you. They will not think that you're incompetent. They will still respect you for it. In fact, probably respect you more. Those are the types of relationships that are characterized by high-performance teams and high-performance meetings. The combination of effective behavior and highly solid relationships. The thing is, at work, how do we reach that level? What is the equivalent at work to the dressing well, the arriving on time, booking the tickets in advance, listening attentively, the caring, and so on and so forth? Well, in terms of meetings, the equivalent is the following. Here are the rules. And let's look, first of all, at the agreeing. You're in agreement with someone in a meeting. A colleague who's presenting something or proposing something, and you agree with them. So often I see in meetings that it happens, and the vast majority of the people remain silent. Unless the person who is managing the meeting specifically asks them their opinion, and then they would tend to say, well, I agree with John or Mark. I think that it would be a wonderful gesture if you took the opportunity to agree with the person publicly in front of all the others, even before the person who's managing the meeting asks for your opinion. If you say, well, I agree with John, almost as if an interruption, how do you think that's going to make John feel? It's going to make him feel supported, cared for, and the fact that you are by his side. That is a really good way to improve your relations at work. You might want to call that effective behavior, or you might want to call it relationship behavior. I don't mind what you call it. To me, it's the right thing to do. There's too much silence. There's too many people in meetings who only seem to talk when they disagree. And there's a great deal of opportunity to publicly agree with someone and give them the support that they need. And even though you're not keeping score, okay, you're not doing anything here so that you deliberately get something back, I don't want to give the impression that you're doing that. But let's just think, what is likely to happen in the future? There's going to come a time when you are going to be in the position where you are proposing something, you're in a meeting, you're having a difficult time, maybe some of your colleagues are disagreeing with you publicly, asking difficult questions. And John is sitting there and he's remembering the time when you publicly supported him. Now, if he agrees with you, don't you think there's a greater chance he's going to jump in there and help you out? And how do you think that mutual assistance, what do you think that's going to do for your teamwork? It's really going to help. So I think that's one of the things that should definitely be done and is not done enough. But what happens if you disagree? I think the softening of disagreement, the I'm afraid part that I mentioned earlier, is not sufficient. Obviously, the meetings you go to are effective meetings. Let's hope so. And you receive an agenda for the meeting before the meeting, with some time for you to prepare for it. Hopefully, on the agenda, you will see not only the start and finish time, where it's going to be, who's going to attend, who's going to run the meeting, but you also will see the subjects of the meeting and the owners of those subjects. Now, if you see on the agenda a subject and you know almost certainly that it's a subject that you will disagree with the owner, or, you know, it's a subject where you have very, very strong opinions and you feel that it's quite likely you're going to disagree with the partner, with your colleague. Do not wait until the meeting to let him or her know this. Do not surprise someone in a meeting with your disagreement. If there's one quick route to destroying a team, that's it. All you need to do is you pick up the phone and you say, "Mark, I've seen we're going to this meeting on Tuesday. I've seen the subject you're going to talk about. Do you mind if we pop out for a coffee for 5 minutes? I'd like to talk to you about it." So you arrange a very relaxed, informal meeting where you will discuss your disagreement with the subject. You'll be giving your colleague an opportunity to think about your disagreement, maybe even to alter what he or she is going to say in the meeting, but at the very least they'll be prepared for it. So come the meeting, when you do publicly say, "I'm afraid, John, I cannot agree with you on that," he will have the opportunity, he will feel confident enough to ask you, "Well, why is that?" You will mention again your ideas, and he will, if he can, if he's been able to prepare and think of some answers, will be able to say them publicly. This will make him look very professional. It will make him look an expert on his subject. And it doesn't diminish your disagreement if John comes up with a good solution to what you have said, but you still don't agree with it. Well, you can continue. But the first comment in the public arena has not been a surprise for him. He's been able to react to your disagreement in a professional and expert manner. And that's what counts. So the pre-warn, I call it the pre-warn, the very informal coffee, relaxed meeting where you discuss your disagreement before the meeting, is a beautiful technique. Now, obviously I've mentioned the goal, what you're trying to get to, the type of effectiveness and relationships you have with people, where, you know, you won't have to do this because you will be able to surprise your colleague in a meeting with your disagreement. But because you've already reached that level of effectiveness and your level of relationship with that person and level of respect, there will be no problem. But these two techniques are ones which allow you to arrive at that goal. They're not ones that you'll need to use once you're there, because that's what characterizes high-performance teams and high-performance meetings. People debate, discuss, with a complete freedom of what they want to say. Of course, they remain professional, and they don't start hitting each other, of course. But there's no fear of what they're going to say, just like the relationships that we have with our loved ones. But these two techniques allow you to get there, allow you to arrive at that point. So in general, we discuss these two issues in meetings with arguing and, with agreeing and disagreeing, to allow you to argue, actually, to allow you to debate, to discuss the things which make meetings valuable to companies and which make them exciting. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. I hope you found it useful. Thank you so much for listening. I'm always amazed by the time that you give me to listen to my podcast. Please, as I often say, try to write these down and use them in the meetings you go to. And if these meetings are not in your English, and English is not the language that you work in, just transfer them into your own language and use them there. They're not techniques just for English. They're techniques for every language. Use them. Try to obtain these level of relationships at work. Try to become more effective. Work on this, because in becoming as professional as you can, in improving the relationships as best as you can at work, your life will be happier. I don't want to seem all emotional here, but the fact is that we spend, 8, 9, 10 hours of our waking day, which if you assume you sleep for 6 or 7 hours, is a great percentage of the time that you have your eyes open at work. Let's make it a happy environment. Let's make it effective. Let's make it productive. Let's make it profitable. And let's excel. Thank you for listening. I hope you found it useful. I hope you've enjoyed it. I look forward to speaking to you again next week. And don't forget your mission. Try these out. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.